We will walk by faith and not by sight. Oftentimes when we consider the story of the Israelites in the Old Testament, faith is not often what comes to mind. It is true that the Apostle Paul tells us in his letter to the church at Corinth that those things are recorded in order that we don't follow in their footsteps. But it's also helpful for us to look from the vantage point of the writer of Hebrews, who describes particularly this story that we're in the midst of now, going through Exodus, from the angle of faith, or through the lens of faith. By faith, he writes, Moses, when he was born, was hidden for 3 months by his parents, because they saw he was a beautiful child, and they were not afraid of the king's edict. By faith, Moses, when he had grown up, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter, choosing rather to endure ill treatment with the people of God than to enjoy the passing pleasures of sin, considering the reproach of Christ greater riches than the treasures of Egypt, for he was looking to the reward. By faith he left Egypt, not fearing the wrath of the king, for he endured as seeing him who is unseen, that is, walking by faith. By faith he kept the Passover and the sprinkling of the blood, so that he who destroyed the firstborn would not touch them. By faith they passed through the Red Sea, as though they were passing through dry land, and the Egyptians, when they attempted it, were drowned. By faith, the walls of Jericho, Joshua chapter 6, which we read about in our reading moments ago, the walls of Jericho fell down by faith after they had been encircled for 7 days. And Joshua gave orders to the Israelites that day. As for you, you who claim to be sons of God, who claim to be the people of God, only keep yourselves from the things under the ban, so that you do not covet them and take some of the things under the ban and make the camp of Israel accursed and bring trouble on it. But all the silver and gold and articles of bronze and iron are holy to the Lord. They shall go into the treasury of the Lord. Chapter 6, verse 24. They burned the city with fire and all that was in it. Only the silver and gold and articles of bronze and iron they put into the treasury of the house of the Lord. Or at least they were supposed to. That brings us to chapter 7, where the writer tells us in the very first verse exactly what he's going to continue to unfold. The anger of the Lord was burning against the sons of Israel in regard to the things under the ban because of unfaithfulness. Think about the contrast here. By faith, by obeying God to the point of merely walking around the impregnable city once a day for 6 days and then 7 times on the 7th day, shouting, blowing trumpets, and the walls fall down. By faith, walls fell down around this impregnable city. And the next battle, it's just a small skirmish up on the hill. There's no need for everyone to go through the trouble of going to the battle. Only send 3,000. And this small skirmish was lost. Lives were lost. The battle was lost. The reputation of God was on the line. We see Joshua even asking the Lord, "What will you do to your great name?" Once all the other enemies hear that this tiny little enemy that should give us no problem at all has sent us running for the hills, they're going to surround us. They're going to wipe us from the face of the planet. And it's not just us that's at stake, God. Your name, what are you going to do about it? Joshua asks. Which should lead us to ask the question, why? Or how? Use any interrogative you want to insert there and come up with an answer. How in the world can you walk around a city one day and it falls down and you go to fight much less of an opponent the next day and you lose? Well, the issue isn't a secret. Everyone knows exactly where I'm going. We're in the midst of this series on the Ten Commandments. We're in the Eighth Commandment this morning. Exodus 20, verse 15. Four short words, you shall not steal. After spending the first four commandments with God dealing primarily with the vertical relationship that we have with Him, that we owe Him ultimate allegiance, we shouldn't have any other gods before Him, we shouldn't call anything else God, we shouldn't use His name in a weightless or careless way, and we should give Him an entire day out of every week exclusively for the purpose of worshiping Him. And for our own sanctification. And then he moves on to the horizontal relationships, dealing with the sanctity of family and the sanctity of life and the sanctity of marriage. And today we will look at the sanctity of property and personal dignity with this commandment, you shall not steal. And in this short, concise, very easy to understand commandment, we have the same two things that we've seen in previous commandments. There's obviously something forbidden in the command. And there is something required. We'll use the Heidelberg Catechism that we've used in past weeks to help answer the question, what does God forbid in the Eighth Commandment? Recorded several hundred years ago. God forbids not only outright theft and robbery punishable by law, but in God's sight, theft also includes all scheming and swindling in order to get our neighbor's goods for ourselves, whether by force or means that appear legitimate, such as inaccurate measurements of weight, size, or volume, fraudulent merchandising, counterfeit money, excessive interest, or any other means forbidden to God. In addition, God forbids all greed and pointless squandering of His gifts. What is forbidden in the Eighth Commandment? Stealing in any form or fashion imaginable or actual. What does God require of us in this Eighth Commandment? You shall not steal. The Heidelberg Catechism records that I do whatever I can for my neighbor's good, that I treat others as I would like them to treat me, and that I work faithfully so that I may share with those in need. If we want to deduct two obvious issues with this command for us, it can be described in this way. First, to steal is a failure to trust in God's providence. Two, to steal is a failure to steward God's provisions. We fail to trust in His providence, so we take. We fail to steward His provisions. We aren't protecting what is ours and what is others. Again, looking into history at what historians, Christians of the past have said, Martin Luther, a person steals not only when he robs a man's strongbox or his pocket, but also when he takes advantage of his neighbor at the market, in a grocery shop, butcher stall, wine and beer cellar, workshop, and in short, wherever business is transacted and money is exchanged for goods or labor. Luther continues, the same must be said of artisans, workmen, and day laborers who act high-mindedly and never know enough ways to overcharge people and yet are careless and unreliable in their work. Now, if we make just a minor shift in the language here, changing the vocations that are mentioned, some of them still apply, but not all of them do. But the words, the principle of what Luther is pointing out is still quite applicable to us. So what are the reasons for our stealing? Well, I've mentioned them before. Failing to trust God's providence. But why? Why do we fail to trust in His providence? Why do we fail to steward the provisions that He's given us in a wise way? There are a number of reasons. I'll mention only three briefly. The first reason is unbelief. We just flat out do not believe that when God says He will take care of us, and when we fail to believe that He will do it in the way that He has designed, by honest work for honest wage, we're falling into the realm of unbelief. The second reason, because of covetousness. I don't have to spend any time there. Lord willing, we'll look at it next week. But we see that the 8th and 9th are closely connected. Another reason would be external solicitation. Not only is there lack of faith and unbelief within, but there's external solicitation, Satan, from without. Why do we steal? Because of unbelief. Unbelieving, coveting hearts that often give way to the outside solicitation of Satan. In what way, or in what ways, are we guilty of stealing? Three ways in particular. From God, from each other, and from self. Will a man rob God? Yes. We must answer the prophet Malachi's question there with yes. By failing to recognize that all of our resources are from Him and for Him. Not only that, but using our breath that He has given us to magnify ourselves or anything else for that matter other than God. We rob Him of the glory that belongs to Him alone. We steal from God when we spend our time on personal self-indulgence rather than as living sacrifices, which is what He has called us as His people to be. When we steal from Him, it offends Him because we are disregarding the law that He's given us to govern our lives. But not only does stealing offend God, but it devalues our neighbor when we steal from them. We're guilty not only of stealing from God, but from our neighbors. If we steal from our neighbors, we're also guilty of stealing from God. They have what they have as a result of God providing for them. Their possessions belong to them, not by chance, but as a result of the Lord's providence. When we steal from someone else, we aren't merely taking their property. It is an outright assault on their dignity as a human being, on their right as a person to labor and earn and own. We're taking that from them, something that God Himself has given them. So we're not only taking from them something, we're taking from them regarding their reputation or their human dignity, and as a result, stealing from God as well. Now, we live in a culture that is basically accustomed to theft. And we expect it because it's so common. You can't go to the grocery store and walk from your car to the entrance without hearing the chirping of alarms with people setting their cars because they assume someone's going to break in and steal it. And they might. I remember several months ago talking to one of the young guys at the detention center. He was there for the second or third time for stealing cars. And he said if people didn't want their cars stolen, they'd stop leaving their keys in them. It wasn't his fault. You know, people kept leaving keys in their cars. I mean, that's the society we live in. Now, I'm guessing not many of us, I hope, are guilty of stealing cars, at least not in the recent past, and hopefully not in the long-term future either. But just because we aren't guilty of something on that level doesn't mean that we aren't overwhelmingly guilty of this eighth command of not to steal. We steal from ourselves, not just God and others. We steal from ourselves when we waste time, when we waste resources. The prodigal son, he spent what was rightfully his. He wasted it. He was stealing from himself by squandering all that his father had saved for him. So what are we stealing? We can cut off the outside world and assume now that we're dealing only with us. Okay, no more cars, no more breaking in, armed robbery. The Eighth Commandment includes those things. And they may be applicable to some of us. But they're not as applicable as some of the other issues at hand. I mean, don't you agree? Most of us have not walked through the supermarket this past week and put something inside our coat or our purse intentionally without paying for it. If you have, see me afterwards. But what are we guilty of stealing? One thing that we're all too often guilty of, I'm afraid, is stealing other people's reputation. William Shakespeare, "Who steals my purse steals trash, but he that filches from me my good name makes me poor indeed." I mean, it should be obvious that things like gossip and slander, when we take part in that, no matter how seemingly small, we're robbing reputation, the reputation of others. It's really a twisted theft as well, because we're doing it for the purpose of lowering them in order that we might secretly somehow elevate ourselves. What else are we guilty of stealing? Well, we are often guilty of stealing time in a couple of different ways, particularly with punctuality. Now, it's easy, you know, because 90% of us were late this morning, for us to think that I'm talking to someone in particular. A few minutes before 10, I looked out the window and there were 3 cars in the parking lot and 2 of them were visitors. Which brings something to mind in thinking about it. Over the past year, I have, for people who have visited several times, I've run through a few questions with them, just kind of asking their thoughts on the church, what it looked like from a visitor's perspective. One of the things that came up more than once was this. I was surprised how few people talked to us when we first arrived. I was surprised for them to tell me that. Because I assume that by and large, I mean, I don't fit this category, but most of you do, are pretty nice and cordial and friendly as far as touching base with people upon their arrival, and especially guests. So it resulted in me having to think through, how could that be? They did go on and say afterwards people were really friendly. And I began to realize, as week by week, when I'm here a few minutes early, usually, the guests are the ones who are here. There's no one to talk to them because all the regulars are still in the parking lot or on their way and haven't made their way here yet. So you have 3 families here. They wonder why they're not talking to each other, and they're all first-time visitors. And all the regulars haven't quite trickled in yet. So punctuality, that's all extra. Okay, that's not in my notes. Let's get back to the notes. So We steal from each other, from ourselves, and from God when we are continually late. When we've agreed to be somewhere, we are stealing time from other people. And the benefit is often lost within ourselves. Now, I know things happen. I'm not saying, you know, every time you're late, you need to have this massive session of repentance as a result of being late. I know that as you're walking out the door, you know, the little one can have an explosive diaper and, you know, you can end up looking at it this morning. They lost Francis's blanket, so they're a few minutes late getting out the door. Those things are going to happen. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about when it is part of our character. I mean, when people associate us with being late, we ought to ask ourselves, in the period of a week or a month or even a year, how much time are we guilty of ripping off from other people? And not just punctuality, but even attendance. How often have you robbed God, others, and yourself? Now, I have an inclination as to why this is such an issue among us. Now, this is really not going to be very applicable to anybody except the regulars here. Well, I'm sure it'll be applicable, but not as much so. But I am becoming increasingly convinced that the flexible nature that home education gives us, which is wonderful when it comes to home education, but I am increasingly convinced that that flexible nature of educating and discipling has also given way to us applying that type of flexibility across the board. When you have no engagements all week, it makes it really hard to know exactly how much time it's going to take to get ready, to eat breakfast, to get all the kids ready, and to drive in the traffic. Now, when we assume that this approach is okay to apply across the board, we may not be guilty of theft, but we're at least flirting with it. Many of us, I'm afraid, are outright guilty of stealing as a result of the poor punctuality. So those are some particular areas that we're guilty, but why? Why are we, again, keeping it in here, why are we stealing? Three possible explanations. I think when we think about stealing, all too often, we think about it on a sliding scale. As if the command has some fluctuating effects based on how much we're stealing. I mean, do you think it's worse to steal a quarter than $25. You see how the fluctuating issue comes to bear. Or the issue of fairness. If we are an employee and we work for a boss who's no doubt raking in the money, maybe we don't think it's that big of a deal to dip into the petty cash or fudge on the expense report. There's plenty there. It's not fair for him to get all the money and for me to work for peanuts. So we run the risk of having this fluctuating idea regarding stealing or being driven by fairness, which is really all make-believe. It's also possible that we could be guilty of applying frequency to the equation. Are you more guilty for stealing three times than you are for stealing once? Or what about three times instead of 300 times? Why are we stealing? Why are we guilty? What are we using to justify theft from God, from others, and from ourselves? It's amazing when you consider how many little areas in our lives where we can easily take a little bit here and rob a little bit there. Slacking off at work, fudging on expense reports, pilfering in the petty cash, falsifying clock-in cards, filing false insurance claims, stealing intellectual property, violating copyrights, music, video duplication. Did you know that recent statistics reveal that 75% of employees in our country steal from their employer? 75%, and half of those do it repeatedly. And the average case value of employee theft is over $600. Now get this, employee theft, the average is over $600, and that's six times the average value of shoplifting. Inside jobs. People who are supposedly committed. I mean, that's where you're getting your bread and butter, so to speak. You're cutting off the hand that feeds you, we might say. The FBI calls employee theft the fastest growing crime in the United States. When it comes to inventory shrinkage, employee theft is cause for 42% of it. Shoplifting is only 35%. You think you could put a number, a figure, on the amount stolen by employees just in our country each year? $50 billion. $50 billion in product. But when it comes to time theft or loafing on the job, U.S. companies estimate that $400 billion a year is lost in productivity. Now, think about those numbers and those statistics, and we claim somehow to be a Christian nation. 90% of Christians say that they never break the eighth commandment, which means they're also guilty of the tenth. It seems more likely that 90% of Christians are guilty of not knowing what stealing means. It's not just burglary and robbery and larceny and hijacking and shoplifting and pickpocketing and purse snatching and embezzlement and extortion and racketeering. I mean, did you know that as a 4-year college student, there's a 1 in 2 chance that your bicycle would be stolen? That's outrageous. But this theft, stealing, robbing God, others, and ourselves, it's not anything new. It's happened from the very beginning. Even the command wasn't new in Exodus chapter 20, as we saw in our introduction to the Ten Commandments. We can go way back to the garden and see that God told Adam and Eve, "I will provide for you. Do not eat from that tree." And unbelief led to them taking the fruit, stealing what was not theirs, not trusting that God would provide. We see it elsewhere. Genesis 27, the familiar story of Jacob stealing, conniving Jacob, stealing from his brother the birthright, a blessing, failure to trust God. He didn't believe God was going to take care of him. And so he took things into his own hands, he and his sneaky mom, revealing that greed and selfishness are at the root of stealing. And it's the same for us, whether it's embezzling millions or taking 10 minutes extra more than what is allowed at lunch. Greed and selfishness are at the root. Now, with each of the commands thus far, we've seen that as we cross over from the Old Testament into the New Covenant times and the coming of Christ, we haven't seen a doing away with the old commands, but rather an intensification of them. And you shall not steal is no different. When Paul's writing to the church at Ephesus after talking with them early on in the chapter about the glories of the gospel and new life that can be found in him, after making clear all that God has done both for them and in them, he then goes on and tells the Ephesians in chapter 4, verse 28, he who steals must steal no longer. Right? That's as far as Exodus 20:15 goes. But that's not as far as New Testament Christianity goes. But rather, he must labor, performing with his own hands what is good, so that he will have something to share with one who has need. It doesn't take much for us to realize that not only are we commanded not to steal, we're commanded to work hard enough and be diligent enough that we not only provide for ourselves, but we have enough to share. The Apostle John, whoever has the world's goods and sees his brother in need and closes his heart against him, how does the love of God abide in him? We can twist that question around and make a statement. If the love of God abides in us and we have the world's goods, and we do, when we see our brother in need, we will not close our heart or our wallet or our time or our thoughts or our prayers towards them. If you turn in your Bibles to Luke chapter 19, we'll close this morning by taking a look at an encounter that Jesus had with a thief one day. In Jericho, Luke chapter 19, we'll read the first 10 verses, and you can try your best to keep the song about Zacchaeus being a wee little man out of your head, especially now since I've reminded you. He entered Jericho and was passing through. That's Jesus. And there was a man called by the name of Zacchaeus. He was a chief tax collector, and he was rich. Zacchaeus was trying to see who Jesus was and was unable because of the crowd, for he was small in stature. So he ran on ahead and climbed up in a sycamore tree in order to see him, for he was about to pass through that way. When Jesus came to the place, he looked up and said to him, "Zacchaeus, hurry and come down, for today I must stay at your house." And he hurried and came down and received him gladly. When they saw it, they all began to grumble, saying, "He has gone to be the guest of a man who's a sinner." Zacchaeus stopped and said to the Lord, "Behold, Lord, half of my possessions I will give to the poor. And if I have defrauded anyone with anything, I will give back four times as much." And Jesus said to him, "Today salvation has come to this house, because he too is a son of Abraham. For the Son of Man has come to seek and to save that which was lost." So here's this man that's making his living off of being a cheat, stealing. And he has this encounter with Jesus. And I'm sure there's much more to it than what's recorded for us, but there's enough recorded. He met Jesus, and as a result, he repented. He's giving back, as we're going to see as soon as we're through with the Ten Commandments and move forward in Exodus 22. We'll see that what Zacchaeus says there is what's required. When you're guilty of stealing something, you pay back four times as much. That's according to the law. That's all fine and good. But we see Zacchaeus as a New Testament believer going the extra mile of what is required as a result of us as Christians and saying, "I will share with the poor. I will make enough and work hard enough to give as well." Jesus said to him, today salvation has come to this house, not because he has said, I'll pay back what I've stolen, not because he's willing to give to the poor. Salvation has come to his house, therefore he has committed to pay back what he has stolen and is willing to assist the poor. The Son of Man has come to seek and to save that which was lost. Or we might say, Jesus has come to seek and to save thieves like you and like me. According to Martin Luther earlier, he was asked once the question, what should we do as a result in thinking about the Eighth Commandment? He said, if we were to hang them all, thieves that is, where shall we get enough rope? And the same is true for us. But there's hope for us. Because though Achan, no doubt the story in Joshua 7 is written clearly for our help, for our benefit, so we don't follow in the same miserable footsteps of giving up everything that results in stoning and burning, or hell we might say for us, just for a nice coat and some pocket change. But Achan wasn't the only one in the line of Judah. There was another one who came several years later from the tribe of Judah. This Son of Man who came to seek and to save that which was lost, and he did seek, and he's still saving, and he's accomplished it by hanging between two thieves. We might say there were three thieves hanging there that day. Not that Jesus was guilty, but your guilt for theft, if you trust in him, was poured out on him. The wrath that your sin, your stealing deserves was poured out that day. Jesus hung there between two trees. Between two thieves from the tribe of Judah, not in a valley called Achor, but on a hill called Golgotha. And he says to us today, Luke 19, salvation has come. The Son of Man has come to seek and to save that which was lost. Not those who are lost, but God saves everything about us. And the evidence of that is we begin to take his law seriously, realizing that he's marked it out so wonderfully clear so that we know how to please him, how to honor him. Even in areas like taking care regarding other people's possessions and reputation and time. May God help us to live on these truths. Let's pray together.